We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Drzezinski, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, I'm happy to be joined by Senator Mike Lee, the Republican from Utah. He's the author of the new book, Saving Nine, The Fight Against the Left's Audacious Plan to Pack the Supreme Court and Destroy American Liberty. That book was released on June 7th. You can get it wherever books are sold. Senator Lee, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Now, speaking of the Supreme Court and norms, as we're taping this episode, news broke within the last 24 hours that the FBI foiled an assassination plot against Justice Kavanaugh. They detained a suspect who admitted he was planning to assassinate the justice within a couple of blocks of Justice Kavanaugh's house. Senator Lee, I have to ask, are Democratic leaders like President Biden, who called for a mini revolution if Roe is overturned, and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, are they in part responsible for this with their loose rhetoric? Is this part of the Democratic effort to undermine norms as you see it?
Okay, those are two different questions. I think as to whether President Biden and Democratic elected officials have undermined norms that are essential to the success of our constitutional republic experiment. The answer to that question is yes, they have, because they're trying rather overtly to undermine the reputation, the integrity of the court, the reputation of the court. And those things have an effect, and it's one of the many reasons why I think it's a mistake for them to speak in such inflammatory terms toward the court. Look, as a lifelong Republican, conservative, and pro-life activist, I have always been bothered by some Supreme Court decisions, and Roe versus Wade is certainly one of them. But I never dreamed of speaking in terms that would suggest that the court's illegitimate. Quite at the contrary, as I like to say, warts and all, the Supreme Court is the best tribunal of its kind anywhere in the world, and America has been blessed by it. As to whether they're responsible for it, I'm always cautious on that front. I don't ever like to believe that anyone else is responsible for actions other than the person who did them, you know, unless they were acting in a conscious overt conspiracy or something like that. I don't think that's what happened here. But I do think it's unfortunate. And I think it's worth noting here that the President of the United States and his Attorney General, his Department of Justice, his FBI haven't taken action against those violating rather openly a federal statute, 18 U.S.C. Section 1507, that prohibits people subject to federal criminal penalty from going to the home of a judge or justice or juror with an attempt to influence the outcome of litigation.
That's a great point. And of course, that's the entire concern with the leak itself. I agree completely. They're not directly responsible for it. But the leak itself is an effort. I mean, do you think the genie can ever be put back in the bottle? You sit on the Judiciary Committee. You've gone through all of these hearings. But if clerks have this in the back of their mind, that whether one of their fellow clerks or a justice perhaps believes something, some decision they're working on presents an existential threat, it can be leaked. Do you think there's a way to deal with this so that intimidation campaign is unsuccessful?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it is possible to put it back in the bottle. I think there's going to have to be a conscious effort to put it back in the bottle. And if we don't put it back in the bottle, it's going to consume the court. It's going to be very damaging. I say that as a member of the Judiciary Committee and as a lawyer and as a former Supreme Court law clerk. Look, what they did with that leak is truly unprecedented, and it's awful. The mainstream news media would have you believe that, oh, it's leaks happen all the time. It's, they at least happen once or twice in a decade. No, not like this. What has happened in the past at most is sometimes people will get wind of what the outcome of a case is going to be. But it's kind of like betting on either red or black at the roulette table. You've got a 50-50 chance of guessing the outcome of almost any case. It's in almost any case argued before the Supreme Court, the result is either going to be affirmed or reversed. And so it's different. Predicting the outcome of a case an hour or two before the opinion is released is very different than what happened here, which is completely unprecedented. Nobody's ever leaked a whole opinion on like this. And there are elaborate procedures within the Supreme Court to make sure this never happens. When I was a law clerk, we had two separate computers tied to two separate databases. The one that you used to edit opinions didn't connect to the outside world. It was completely sealed. Whenever you had a printed hard copy of a draft opinion, you couldn't just throw it in the trash can. When you were finished, you had to put it in a burn bag. At the end of the day, somebody came along, picked that up. They shredded it, not just once, but twice until it was a fine confetti. Then they'd put it in an incinerator and burn it, and then mix it with water to turn it into a sludge-like paste, all before it left the custody of the Supreme Court. So that's how seriously they take the confidentiality of the opinion drafting process. The fact that this leaked shows how deliberate this was, and it was not done with an eye toward encouraging people to send flowers or a fruit basket to Supreme Court justices. This was designed to threaten, intimidate, harass, and isolate them. And that is truly criminal.
I don't want to dwell on this. I think that's all very well said. It's unthinkable to me that the Supreme Court doesn't know who leaked this at this point. Do you have any indication of where that investigation is?
I believe that they either know by this point or they've been sloppy and careless in the way they've carried it out. And I refuse to believe that it's the latter. I'm therefore going to continue to believe they know who it is. Look, I believe that if you gave me access to an investigator, let's assume for a minute they haven't found out. If you gave me access to an investigator, a federal agent, I said this to my friend Dan Bongino, who is a former Secret Service agent. I said, if they gave me you and access to the Supreme Court clerks and a few hours and I could interview every one of them, I could figure out who did it. I guarantee it. These law clerks all know each other. Each justice has only four of them. It's their whole legal team. Each one has four young lawyers as their law clerks. They all know each other. They've been working together since July. You talk to each one of them about who had the motive, opportunity, modus operandi, contacts that would be consistent with this. You could figure it out.
So why the silence on it?
I've speculated that maybe they're waiting until the end of the term and until this opinion in the Dobbs case itself is released. Perhaps the court doesn't want to reveal too much about the court's internal processes until that case has come to a rest.
No, that makes sense. Now, to zoom back out to the 30,000-foot level that a lot of this book is at, you actually begin with an epigraph in the introduction from Ruth Bader Ginsburg herself. Yeah. And you kind of talk about how this went from boneheaded to mainstream. I think that's actually one of the chapter titles. I'm curious as to why you think it is that people on the left have looked back with the benefit of hindsight on what FDR tried to do critically. And then why you think that's now changing?
Okay, so they looked back on it critically, in part because at the time it never even had the support of all Democratic politicians. In fact, it couldn't get through the Senate, notwithstanding the fact that FDR had very considerable majorities, substantial majorities in both houses of Congress. Still couldn't get past the Senate. Is not all the Democrats supported it. Even the Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee weren't enough to get it passed out of the committee. And they realized the extent to which this amounted to bullying on FDR's part. This was petulant behavior by Franklin D. Roosevelt, who was tired of not winning because the Supreme Court wouldn't effectively amend the Constitution in order to clear the path for his New Deal programs, which, whether you agree with them or not, were constitutionally problematic. So he threatened his way into this and got the Supreme Court to effectively amend the Constitution without following the amendment process, and delegitimized the court and politicized the court in the process. We're paying for it to this day, as I explained in the book. It's why we're $31 trillion in debt. It's why most of our law is now federal, and most of that law is now made not by elected lawmakers, but by unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats. All of that can be traced, I believe, to a decision rendered on April 12, 1937, stemming from the flip-flopping of Associate Justice Owen Roberts, who was scared to death of FDR and his court packing plan. That's why he rewrote the Commerce Clause. We're still paying for it to this day. That's why I wrote this book. The American people aren't being taught this. You're not taught this in high school civics class, in college courses on political science and government. You're not even taught much about this in law school. But this has been something of a hobby of mine for about as long as I can remember. And I feel like it's time to finally tell the story, let the American people know the truth about FDR and how he delegitimized the Supreme Court. And the impact of that was not limited to his failed court packing plan. It wasn't even limited to the court itself. It affects all of us to this day. So we got to be worried about that, because what would happen next, the next time we threaten to pack the court?
Well, and we're in another moment where there are, I think, pretty serious threats to pack the court. And on that note, I kind of want to ask if you've seen changes in your colleagues on the Judiciary Committee over the course of like the Trump era, where the left responded to what they saw as an erosion of norms by saying, well, we should maybe erode some norms, too. How serious are the threats to the Supreme Court right now, norms that we believe in on the Supreme Court? And do you think any of your colleagues on the Judiciary Committee are also flirting with court packing schemes?
As to the second question, yes, absolutely. And in fact, unlike in 1937, this is why this scares me so much. That's why Saving Nine is so timely and so important, and so important for people to read right now. Unlike in 1937, I'm not seeing a single Democratic voice raising a voice of warning over this. They're all either remaining silent, or they're openly advocating for packing the Supreme Court, or as they like to put it euphemistically, expanding the court, court expansion. It's one of Elizabeth Warren's favorite hashtags right now, hashtag expand the court. And so we don't have any real opposition from among and between Democrats right now. So talk about norm busting. Good heavens. These guys are really behaving dangerously in this area. This just a year or so after Chuck Schumer went over to the steps of the Supreme Court and said, you know, you will reap the whirlwind. You will not even know what hit you. I mean, who does that? As an officer of the court, as an attorney, which I believe he is, that's irresponsible conduct.
Yeah. And I'm thinking of a criticism I hear a lot from one of our senior tech columnist, Rachel Bovard, who's also over at the Conservative Partnership Institute, who talks a lot about how Republicans have contributed to kicking the can over to the judiciary over and over again. And you actually quote Alexander Hamilton in Federalist 78 in the book. Hamilton says in 78 that the judiciary branch should be the, quote, least dangerous, which is such an interesting phrase, especially right now. Have Republicans contributed to a shift away from that by failing to maybe tackle major issues in the legislative branch?
Sure. Whenever we behave as the uniparty, whenever we fail to show contrast between our party and the other party, because the views for which we purport to stand, the differences between the two parties are pretty great, but the differences between the way members of both parties vote in Congress is sometimes not as great as the differences between our platforms. And it's one of the reasons why Rachel Bovard is awesome, and why I really we should consider a draft Rachel Bovard for president in 2028. I think we should give her until then to get ready, but you know, it's time for President Bovard. Anyway, she'd be fantastic because she grasps this point. We've contributed to some of this, and some of those Republicans who most dislike Donald Trump disliked him because of his norm busting qualities. First of all, nothing compared to what Democrats have done. Secondly, a lot of that and a lot of his popularity was an outgrowth of the perception rooted in a lot of reality that Republicans have sometimes, I was speaking of some, not all, but some Republicans on the Hill for a very long time have viewed the approach to conservatism as, let's figure out where the Democrats are and meet them half of the distance, go half the distance to where they are. And as they've continued to move further and further to the left, that has busted our norms as a party, and it's gotten us into some dangerous territory, constitutionally speaking.
Cancel culture is coming to your bank, and holding the wrong political views might soon leave you out in the cold. I'm Bill Walton. On the latest episode of The Bill Walton Show, Todd Zwicky, Paul Watkins, and I discuss what is already happening, how the Biden administration is already pursuing this agenda, and what we can do about it. This progressive culture offensive is relentless. It's coming for you, and you won't hear about this anywhere else. Follow The Bill Walton Show at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
President Biden said something especially ridiculous on Jimmy Kimmel's show last night, where he basically said, you know, he's resisting calls for him from the left to tackle gun control via executive order because he doesn't want to follow in Donald Trump's footsteps and erode judicial norms, I guess, which is, I mean, amazing coming from someone who's in the administration that, you know, did DACA and all of that stuff. But he's making this point. He said the democracy would literally be at stake. He sort of, that's the argument that he made. The left would say that Republicans under Leader McConnell, Minority Leader McConnell, eroded judicial norms themselves. This is a really common argument on the left, that it's Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell who have contributed to undermining the judiciary system's credibility. How do you respond to those charges?
Yeah. First of all, I find those charges irritating because they're so wildly wrong. I mean, number one, it's rich that President Biden would say, oh, no, I'm not going to do that because that would be an abuse of executive power and an intrusion to things that are not my own. This is coming from the man who is responsible for the single most aggressive, abusive act of executive branch overreach that I've ever seen, certainly in my lifetime. In fact, I think you have to go back to the spring of 1952 to find another act of presidential overreach more brazen, bold, and potentially harmful. That was when Harry Truman seized every steel mill in America to assist in the Korean War effort in the midst of some labor relations disputes that he was worried about. Now, the Supreme Court, fortunately, was on standby on that one. It was able to handle the case, and it dropkicked that action, pointing out that it was wildly unconstitutional. But Joe Biden tried to compel over 100 million Americans to get a vaccine they didn't want on the thinnest of executive authorities with his OSHA vaccine mandate. It was just absolutely absurd. With regard to the accusation that Republicans have norm busted, have packed the court, or have otherwise affected the integrity of the court somehow by confirming Trump nominees, this is patently absurd, absolutely patently absurd. Look, we confirmed Republican nominees to the Supreme Court and to other courts because those vacancies existed and we chose to confirm them. There is nothing about that that amounts to or resembles or should be met with the same kind of contempt as court packing. There's nothing about that that's the same. To the extent that they're still bitter over the fact that we didn't confirm Merrick Garland, that is, in fact, our prerogative. The president nominates, the Senate confirms or chooses not to confirm. We chose not to confirm Merrick Garland. So nothing about that changes the judiciary. Nothing about that was unconstitutional or anti-constitutional. It's just the way our system works.
Speaking of that sort of Bovardian criticism, there was a slim window for Republicans to pass legislation under Donald Trump. And in retrospect, some people have said the focus on the tax cut legislation was kind of a misalignment or reflected a misalignment of priorities in the Republican Party. When you look back on that and you look forward, actually, with the expected red wave in the fall, potentially Republican president in 2024, given where Joe Biden's approval rating is, Are there lessons to be learned from that? Do you think voters could expect maybe legislation or legislative priorities that would better reflect their priorities if Republicans retake control of the legislative branch?
Yes. Yes, I think so. No, it's not that I regret the tax bill. I wasn't perfect, but that tax bill did a lot of good, and I'm glad we did it. There's no reason why it happened had to happen to the exclusion of other priorities. We can walk and chew gum at the same time. Democrats do it all the time. We ought to be able to do the same for our priorities. Look, if it were up to me, if I had a single legislative priority to advance, if a genie appeared to me and said, you can get any single bill through Congress, it would probably be the RAINS Act. The RAINS Act, it's an acronym, R-A-I-N-S, stands for Regulations from the Executive in Need of Scrutiny. That would be my genie pick. And I still think that should be the top of our legislative priority. I think we had a campaign on it. We probably need a new name for the RAINS Act. I've found it to be cumbersome and not terribly appealing. But basically, in a nutshell, what the RAINS Act says is that federal law should be made by elected lawmakers, as Article 1 of the Constitution already requires, and not by unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats. If we just made that one change would essentially restore the protection of separation of powers in our Constitution, what I refer to it as a horizontal protection. Indirectly, it would also help restore the vertical structural protection of federalism. We've deviated from both of them dangerously over the last 85 years. And as I point out in Saving Nine, chapters 4 and 5 in Saving Nine, I make the case that all this happened, our deviation from the vertical protection of federalism and from the horizontal protection of separation of powers, they happened simultaneously, and I trace all of them to April 12, 1937, the moment when Associate Justice Owen Roberts, apparently justices named Roberts have a tendency to be kind of squishy, he flipped his vote in response to threats and intimidation by Franklin D. Roosevelt, in this case called NLRB versus Jones and Laughlin Steele. They redefined what the Commerce Clause meant, turning us from a limited purpose federal government to a general purpose national government. And eventually flowed from that this erosion of separation of powers, because Congress couldn't handle all this newfound responsibility over labor, manufacturing, agriculture, and mining. So we outsourced all of it to unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats who now make most of our decisions. Now we basically pass laws that say we shall have good law in area X. We delegate to Commission Y the power to make, interpret, enforce rules carrying the force of generally applicable federal law in that area. Have fun. And that's the end of it. So anyway, that's what I would do. It's a long-winded way of saying I think that has to be our priority. I think aggressive regulatory reform, pushing the lawmaking task back into the hands of federal lawmakers instead of unelected and unaccountable bureaucrats. That is the mother lode of all other reforms. And I think that's what we had to focus first and foremost on.
Do you think Leader McConnell has absorbed those lessons? That was part of the dust up between the sort of Rick Scott camp and the Mitch McConnell camp when Rick Scott released his plan. He spoke about it, the Heritage Foundation. It's just this implication that the priorities of the party, especially in the Senate, have been misaligned. Do you think that Senator McConnell has sort of been receptive to those critiques, or that looking back on the Trump administration, things might be different going forward?
I hope so, and I kind of think so. I mean, I think particularly in light of recent events to which you refer, I think he's seen the fact that there is some hunger for an affirmative policy agenda and for some articulation. You know, I understand some of his reluctance in that he doesn't want to overpromise, overcommit, or get us painted into a corner. And part of that relates to his role, the role of the Republican leader. Very often involves, you know, the combination of cat herding and traffic management and that sort of thing. But at the same time, I do think, and I also very much hope that he grasps the genuine void and the yearning hunger for an affirmative policy agenda, because that's part of what's we can't get by for very long. We're not going to win as many elections as we'll need to over time just by being against what the Democrats want to do. We also have to have what we're for, in part so that when we do get the chance to do things the way we'd like to do them, we will do the right thing.
Absolutely. And speaking of which, I remember asking Senator Blackburn, your colleague on the Judiciary Committee, when Ketanji Brown Jackson was being confirmed ahead of the confirmation hearing, if she was scrutinizing Jackson's record on antitrust issues. And she said yes, which was so interesting because I don't know if Republicans would have been, if that would have been top of mind in this way, 10 years ago. If the American Innovation and Choice Online Act that Senator Klobuchar has spearheaded comes to the floor, and that's a controversy in and of itself. How would you expect Republicans to vote on that bill?
No. I mean, I'll vote no on it.
Yeah.
There are parts of it that are well-intentioned, and there are parts of it that are horribly written.
Yeah. And do you think Senator Klobuchar failed to cooperate? One of the things I've sort of been picking up on is that Democrats aren't necessarily serious about meeting Republicans reasonably on some of these like obvious bipartisan issues. Do you think that was a problem with this bill?
Absolutely. It's the best, most concise distillation of that markup where that was passed. It was shoved through the committee through will of sheer force by Senator Klobuchar, and you know, got to hand it to her. She exerted a lot of will on there, and it worked. But I don't know that is going to bode well for the legislation passing on the floor. I proposed a number of meaningful reforms, some of which she's incorporated, but a lot of which she dropped, kicked into next Tuesday and said, no, I'm not interested in looking at it. And some of those concerns involve things that some Democrats even shared. They were concerns that they had, too. But you could see from across the dais, she was not going to have anything of it. And some of them went ahead and voted against some of my amendments, even those that they were sympathetic toward, just because she told them not to. And that really doesn't help to build a genuine lasting coalition on a bill like that. It's pretty groundbreaking stuff that she's got. Mm-hmm. And you've got to be careful with that you not be too hasty.
Do you worry then that many of your colleagues will vote for the bill if it ends up being brought to the floor because they don't want to sort of be seen on the side of big tech right now?
Yeah, some will, but as of right now, I don't think they've got enough people who are willing to commit to it. You've got some who might vote for it if it were brought to the floor, but you've got a lot who are not yet willing to commit to voting for it. And until they do that, it's hard to bring it to the floor. It's a chicken and egg problem.
Hmm. So I definitely consider my incessant skepticism both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in journalism for sure. But as I've watched all of these MyPillow ads over the years, I have just been plagued by the question, are these as good as the commercials say they are? I've always wondered this. And when the fine folks over at MyPillow were kind enough to send me some of their products, I was really pleasantly surprised. These things are great. And right now they're having a BOGO extravaganza. So you can get buy one, get one free price on the MyPillow bed sheets as low as $59.98, the Elegance MyPillows as low as $49.98, and that six-piece towel sets. Those are my favorite. Those are included in the BOGO extravaganza. Also, the Roll and Go Anywhere MyPillows for $29.98 and so much more. Those six-piece towel sets are made with cotton grown here in the United States. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch. I can confirm that. It's absolutely true. Like I said, these are my favorites. They have no lotiony feel either. Every set comes with two bath towels, two hand towels, and two washcloths. So you got everything you need. They're available in a variety of colors and sizes, and they are machine washable and come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a one-year limited warranty. Those Roll and Go Anywhere MyPillows, you can use them on your couch, your recliner, or in your car. They're versatile enough to take on vacation or really anywhere you go. They're also available in multiple colors and patterns and machine washable and dryable for all you parents. That's the most important part. They come with a 10-year warranty and a 60-day money-back guarantee as well. So as you can see, it's a buy one, get one extravaganza over at mypillow.com/Federalist. Bed sheets and MyPillows are just the tip of the iceberg. Find the full list of BOGO offers by visiting mypillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794 8429. Stock up with buy one, get one free savings today and get Mike's book free with any purchase. MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. MyPillow.com/Federalist. Now, just like one question on the race, you're for re-election right now. I don't, again, don't want to dwell on that. I think the Supreme Court is a much bigger problem than your race in Utah right now. But I'm curious, there was a poll, I think it was from Desiree, that was almost within the margin of error. If the election were held today, Mike Lee or Evan McMullen, you were up by about 4 points. And I think the margin of error was something like 3.78 plus or minus. And I do not understand Utah politics for the life of me. I just cannot wrap my head around how Evan McMullen would be pulling at that level. I know he's not running as a Republican, but I truly don't get it. So, two-part question. One, are you feeling pretty confident? These kinds of polls come out during elections all the time. Are you feeling pretty confident you'll prevail ultimately? And then two, how do you expect Senator Romney to handle the race?
Super easy questions. So, all right, I disagree with the poll. The polling methodology had some pretty fundamental flaws. And my own internal polling shows me with a much more substantial lead than that. That said, I am taking it very seriously and preparing for it. There are, you know, Evan McMullen is someone who ran in 2016 for president, ran in some ways as a more conservative alternative to Donald Trump. He ran in part saying that Trump was insufficiently pro-life, insufficiently conservative in other ways, but that he was insufficiently committed certainly to trying to work to have Roe versus Wade overturned. And guess what Evan McMullen said just recently on MSNBC, went on there and said he doesn't think we should overturn Roe versus Wade. He seems to have certain chameleonic properties that have allowed him to have the flexibility of an acrobat and no apparent shame in shifting. I don't know that bodes particularly well for him. As to my colleague from Utah, gosh, I don't know. I can't speak for him. What he's told me is that he's friends with both of us and he'd rather stay out of the race. That's his prerogative.
Can you explain why there's that video that went kind of viral of Spencer Cox introducing himself, your governor, with preferred pronouns, and Evan McMullen's statement on the leaked Dobbs decision. He took a swipe at the pro-life movement, basically. It was weird. And just as an outsider, again, I said I do not understand Utah politics, but why is it, do you think, that sort of softening on social conservative issues seems to be what a particular group thinks of as politically expedient in Utah at the moment?
Yeah, I don't quite get it. Utah's an interesting place. It's really a conservative state. We have zero conservative media. I mean, with a couple of exceptions, we got a couple of awesome radio talk show hosts, my friend Boyd Matheson and my friend Rod Arquette. They're both on the radio. Other than them, we have zero conservative media. I mean, print media, radio, TV. They're all lefties, all of them. And so when you have those institutions sending messages over and over again, over time, it has an effect. And that saddens me. It's also disappointing. But I think that's part of what's going on. And then you have this weird feedback loop in which those same entities are the same ones conducting these polls, reporting on the polls, reporting things in the light most favorable to them. And I think they're overstating their strength a bit, but they're also having some impact.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. You've been so generous with your time. I'm wondering if you have an elevator pitch, maybe a little bit, maybe a really long elevator ride. You're in Manhattan and you're going up the Freedom Tower, and somebody confronts you about why saving nine is important. Why is the Supreme Court so central? And you know, you're trying to convince this person that that number nine is rooted in a specific and good principle. What would you say to them?
Okay. there's nothing magical about the number nine. As I explain in my book, Saving Nine, this is a statutory feature, not a constitutional mandate. Congress can, in a legal, technical sense, increase that number without violating the Constitution. In that respect, court packing, counterintuitively, is not unconstitutional. It is, however, wildly, violently anti-constitutional. It is hostile toward our constitutional system. And the reason is, having settled on the number nine since 1869, so going on 153 years, to change that now for partisan political purposes, for purposes of achieving a different result in cases, would do great violence to the independence of the federal judiciary. The independence of the federal judiciary is the sine qua non, the hallmark characteristic, the conditioned precedent for liberty in our constitutional republic. We cannot have freedom without an independent federal judiciary. You don't have that if you politicize the Supreme Court of the United States. You will politicize the Supreme Court of the United States if you pack the court by adding justices, not because of a human resources problem or it's not that you've got a workforce allocation mismatch. It's not that. They just want different outcomes. And so if you change it politically, you're going to turn the court from an impartial tribunal into a highly politicized, almost a political body, one that will, by the way, eventually become very large. Because as a result of lifetime tenure, you can't simply increase the size of the court and then rapidly decrease the size of the court. You got to wait until somebody dies, resigns, retires, or is impeached and removed or something like that.
It's maybe a weird place to make that argument right now, as the 1619 project is being exported to high school classrooms, actually just classrooms around the country, where the value of the Constitution itself, the value of the judiciary system, the argument against direct democracy is in and of itself being called a relic of a racist system, and one that's not worth preserving. So is making this argument in today's environment, is that an added layer of difficulty to persuading people?
Look, ultimately, no. I don't think so. I get your point, but I actually think that strengthens our argument. Hmm. It strengthens the moral imperative for people needing to read Saving Nine and needing to defend the Constitution against this attack, as I advocated Saving Nine. Because most of the people in the United States of America fundamentally agree with and believe in the Constitution. They may or may not believe, as I do, that the Constitution was written by very unusually wise men raised up by God to that very purpose. But they do grasp on some level that to the extent we followed it, and because we followed it, it's fostered the development of the greatest civilization the world has ever known, the strongest economy, the greatest military ever assembled. All as a result of this, because the Constitution unlocks unlimited human potential. It allows you to be you, to do what you do best, to work hard, to provide for your family, to build a better tomorrow, and it defines the role of the government. Most Americans fundamentally believe in that promise, in that bargain. And so once they're presented with this option, look, it highlights in some ways the contrast between our view and theirs. Theirs is that the Constitution is flawed, the Constitution is unreliable, the Constitution is outdated, outmoded, we got to move beyond it. And as part of that, just as the independent judiciary is a conditioned precedent to our concept of liberty and a good outcome, packing the Supreme Court, delegitimizing the court, politicizing the court, remaking the court in their own image is a conditioned precedent to them achieving their progressive post-apocalyptic hellscape that they so badly, inexplicably want. So here's the thing. The stories that I tell, the information that I supply in Saving Nine, I decided to write the book when it started to become apparent to me that they were actually going to do this. Mm. I had all this stuff in the back of my mind because I'm interested in it, and I've done my own research on it since I was in college and law school. But this stuff is not taught in schools anymore. It's not taught in elementary or junior high civics classes. It's not taught in most high schools, most colleges. Even in most law schools, they spend very little time talking about the Supreme Court case decided on April 12, 1937, when Owen Roberts decided to squish out. It's hardly discussed. It's hardly discussed that the Supreme Court effectively amended the Constitution that day without going through the amendment process. And had it been an actual amendment, it would have been among the five most significant amendments ever adopted. They don't talk about that. So if people read Saving 9, they'll gain access to this information. And the more of us who are educated and informed on that, the more likely we can save the Constitution and save the court. So I just want people to read it. I prefer that people buy a copy. If they don't want to buy a copy, just go to a library and borrow it from somebody else. Whether you buy it or not, just read it, because we need people to be armed with the facts. Once the American people realize what's been taken from them, they'll realize the extent to which it could get a lot worse. We may not be able to undo what happened in 1937, but I know this, our constitutional system can't endure another direct hit, an existential threat like court packing again. We've got to be ready to pounce on this thing and to be armed with the facts, and that's why I wrote Saving 9.
Are you going to give a copy to your colleagues?
Heck yeah, absolutely. That's a great idea. I'm glad you thought of that. And by the way, especially if you're a conservative, you will never lose another political argument again in your life after you read Saving 9, because it's about much more than the court. It is, yeah. It helps you win any argument about politics, especially any argument that involves the separation of powers between the three branches, the difference between state power and federal power. And here's the little hint. Everything in American politics today relates in one way or another to those two dynamics.
Senator Lee, you have been very generous with your time, and I so appreciate your willingness to talk through some of these timely issues and some of these timeless issues. So thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been great talking to you. Keep in touch.
Of course. Well, the book is
Bovard
called
for President.
Yeah. Okay. Let's not flatter her too much. Speaking of which, congratulations to Rachel on the birth of her baby last week.
Yes, exactly. She's going to be an outstanding mother, and that first child, I mean that in the presidential sense, is going to have a great time in the White House.
That's great. She's going to love this. The book is Saving 9, The Fight Against the Left's Audacious Plan to Pack the Supreme Court and Destroy American Liberty. Senator Lee, thank you again.
Thank you. Take care.
You've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
I heard the faint voice of reason, and then it faded away.